begin by just a couple of words about what seems to be happening right now on campuses with the anti-sweat campaigns. And as the anti-sweat campaigns increasingly are also embracing the living wage campaigns for a living wage amongst all campus workers. I think this represents one of the most exciting trends in youth activism today. It really is putting into practice the call to think globally and act locally. It really is showing that people, even while you're at school, are not powerless. It means that students are starting to seriously take the values, the ethics, the responsibility that universities say we're about teaching, but we really don't actually want you to practice them here, like, you know, right on campus, right? It's sort of, we have this U-turn theory that somehow we'll teach you all of those things, and then when you leave here into the real world, then we want you to practice all those things, but not while you're here. Well, students have rejected that by getting involved right now. They've also learned to, and through these campaigns, have, in a very powerful way, challenged authority. Not just external authority, the authority of large corporations, but even local authority, university authority. You know, when we tell people to speak truth to power, we forget to tell them that they don't exactly like it when you speak truth to power. But students are really starting to shake up, I think, the universities. And not just the universities, stores, companies, and all sorts of authority. They're starting to challenge corporate power and breaking that sense of powerlessness that has been such a part of this globalization. You know, they use the term TINA, there is no alternative. You know, who are you? Just a student, right? How the hell can you deal with the forces of neoliberalism, marketization, free trade, privatization, deregulation? Geez, you know, I can barely make tuition, right? And yet, by starting to organize right where you are on things that matter, but moving beyond where you are into the wider issues of globalization, that there is alternatives, that there are choices, and that the institutions that we're a part of must make the correct choice. Students are doing a fantastic job. They're practicing, in fact, a very, very dangerous, wonderful practice. It's called democracy, the right and responsibility to participate in decisions that affect you and that are being made in your name. And most important, they're learning to organize. And that's a vital skill for citizens in any democracy. It's a difference, in my mind, between having rights, you know, something you hang up on the wall, versus actually exercising rights. And they're learning that to exercise rights, you need to actually form organizations. That's why workers form unions. Because, in fact, you don't have many rights in the workplace, but even those rights you do have in the workplace, you can't use unless you have a vehicle through which you can express those rights. You know, my favorite is I got here in 5 hours flat flaunting the traffic code, and I did that because I have a little document in writing that gives me the right to drive. It's a driver's license from Massachusetts, so watch out. But I can stand on the freeway and I don't go anywhere with that document, because having something in writing doesn't get you anywhere. You actually need a vehicle to express the right given to you in writing. And that's why I got a car. And it's the same thing for workers, that you can have rights and you can hear about them, but that doesn't mean anything unless you got a vehicle through which you can express those rights. And students are discovering that by creating such vehicles on the campus. When they go to the administration and they start to say, you know, we don't think Cornell or Harvard or Duke or UMass should be putting its label, its very, you know, what did they tell you? That the name of the university is so important. It represents your future. That's why the tuition's so expensive, right? We protect the quality. And yet, they'll put it on garments, produced by sweated labor. And so when you go and you challenge them on that, you discover that they don't have to listen to you. They say, thank you very much. You know, we appreciate your concern. We feel your concern. Get back to class. And so, but then when you start to organize, then when you put it right under their nose, then when you start to do research, then when you link to the union, Unite, that organizes apparel and garment workers, then when you start to bring in garment and apparel workers from other countries, all of a sudden you start to build a more powerful movement. And in fact, you start to understand things like the devil's in the detail, that the empire strikes back. Just when you think you got a deal from the administration, you actually got it in writing, you read the fine print, and you learn a fun thing about labor law. They give you something in the first clause and take it away in the second, third, and fourth, which is very much what the universities have been doing around the Fair Labor Association and their attempts to promise living wages, promise fair contracting, and in fact taking it away by their practice. And most of all, you're learning about solidarity. Solidarity, I always say, versus charity. Charity is sort of Lady Bountiful. You know, you stoop, you know, we're in privileged situations, nice university, we stoop to help those less fortunate. That's charity. Civil society and democracies aren't built on charity. They're built on solidarity. And the difference is that solidarity is actually mutual aid. That by helping others, you start to learn that you can learn from them. That we think we're just helping them, but we're not. We're learning. It's a mutual engagement. It's mutual aid, mutual learning. What we demand for ourselves was the motto of my former labor movement. What we demand for ourselves, we desire for all. An injury to one is an injury to all. Well, the origins and the power of these movements really are almost like laboratories for learning, I think, for the type of vehicles that we need to build to change American society. When you're in school, it's a time when you've got the opportunity to think a little bit about the type of society we should be. Most of us believe that we should be an economic and social just society. But such a society would only be the product of a genuinely democratic society. And ours, quite frankly, is not that democratic society. We're neither just nor democratic. And to make ourselves just, we have to become democratic. And the fight for justice is, in fact, the fight for true democracy. Now, if you want to fight for a problem, any problem, one of the things you learn is that it's best to go to the source. That you can, you know, the environmentalists used to do this. When the environmentalists first started out, they were sort of garbage pickers. They would go to the end of the cycle and pick up after things had been polluted, after things had been spilled. And then the environmentalists got smart and they said, wait a minute, let's move things back to the source. Let's try and capture problems in the environment, pollution and other problems at the source and prevent it from being created. Similarly, I would say that we need to think the same way on democracy. And in my mind, the source of injustice and the denial of democratic rights in the United States and internationally is, in fact, private monopolies and tremendous concentration, private concentration of wealth and power. And they are major corporations. And it's their drive to replace democratic and public control and decision-making with markets and private power and private decision-making. Today, in my mind, the front line of that battle for democracy is taking place in the workplace. If you think about what democracy is, it's the role of, or it's the rule of the demos, the rule of the people, your right to participate in decisions that affect you. It's a process and an ongoing process. It's not an end product. You don't tell a democracy by saying it has certain artifacts like, gee, they have a president, they must be a democracy. No, you can have a president and have all sorts of authoritarian regimes. It's the quality of the process that leads the vast majority of people to be able to choose who will rule them. It's the process that determines whether it's a democracy, not the end product. And this idea about people being able to participate in decisions that affect them, that wasn't meant to be just sort of every 2 years at election time by going to the ballot box. It was meant to be in many places where decisions are made. Democracy, as we know in America, stops at the workplace door. We still are, in fact, we still have feudal vestiges in our society. If you think about the law of the workplace, it really goes back to the Master-Servant Act. It goes back to a feudal vestige in Great Britain. I mean, that makes us very unique. We're the only society that never had feudalism, but has a feudal vestige. So, you know, we at least have a brag point there. But the basic law of the workplace, forget the Wagner Act, under the Wagner Act, the National Labor Relations Act, passed in 1935, underlying the relationship in the workplace is the Master-Servant Act. And that's why, in fact, employees owe loyalty to the employer. I think about that. In a free society, what a bullshit notion. You know, I pledge allegiance to the employer. That's stupid. Why does an employee owe loyalty? The employer doesn't owe loyalty to the employee. Well, that goes back to the Master-Servant Act. And unfaithful servants could be dismissed. That's why, even to this day, in the private sector workplace, disloyalty, refusing to follow orders, can get you fired. And in fact, it's even worse than that. You can be fired for no reason. The law of the land is one called the doctrine of employment at will. That means employees in private sector workplaces are hired and fired at the will of the employer. You can be fired for any reason or no reason. You can't be fired for a discriminatory reason. You can't be fired for being black. Can't be fired for being female, can't be fired for being disabled, and can't be fired for being elderly. You can be any of those and none of those, as long as you're carefully fired for no reason, that's legal. Now, that's a bizarre situation. It is, of course, a step forward. It's not quite slavery, and it's not indentured servitude, but it's not the robust expression of democratic rights for workers that we would expect going into the next millennium. You would think we would have, you know, a slightly higher measure. Labor law in the United States doesn't give workers much rights. I mean, essentially, think about the nature of our labor law. What labor law we have assumes that the natural state of the workplace is union-free. Again, that's the wrong default for a democracy, that the natural state of the workplace is union-free, i.e., the natural state of the workplace is that workers have no rights, and that labor law then lays out a series of barriers getting higher and higher over which workers must climb in order to win rights. You would think in a democracy we would have the reverse. The natural state of the workplace should be that employees have the right, in fact, the responsibility to participate in decisions that affect them. That should be the default. Now, we're a democracy, so those employees should be permitted to, you know, have a campaign amongst their employees and to try and argue the point and see if they can win 50% plus one, and the government can come in and supervise that election with 50% plus one of the employees saying, I can't deal with the responsibility of having a voice over decisions in the workplace, and therefore I would like to vote to get rid of that. Well, you know, sure, we should permit that, and if they want to do that, that's fine. Our labor law, in fact, is the complete opposite. Labor law in a truly democratic society would truly recognize what are, in fact, international rights, the freedom of association, the right to organize. And in fact, our labor law isn't about giving workers the right to organize, isn't about freedom of association. It goes on page after page after page, court decision after court decision essentially denying these rights to American workers. Now, you probably think I sound a tad radical, but do up your seatbelts because it gets better, or worse, depending on which side you're on. But it might ask, well, wait a minute, such robust, such strong rights for workers. Doesn't the employer have a right here? I mean, Elaine, wouldn't this violate, you know, owners' rights? You know, let's hear it for the owners. I mean, gosh, you know, don't they have any rights? Well, of course they've got rights. They've got rights of ownership. But ownership isn't an absolute. Ownership is something that is given. It's not part of the Ten Commandments. I checked. It's not, you know, it's not a natural law. It's a civil law. It's a law that we established. Ownership, as anyone in law school will tell you, is not an absolute. It's legally defined and protected as a relationship. I'll give you an example. I own my own home. I actually managed to pay off the mortgage. So you don't get into more serious ownership than I got. I mean, it is my home. I own it. I got a deed. It's mine. And yet, there are rules that apply to me in spite of the fact that I have my own turf, my own soil, etc. I can plant, for the most part, any plant I want, with certain narcotic exceptions. I can't store toxic waste in it. I can't even burn the damn thing down. There's tremendous restrictions on my rights as an owner in society. Well, of course there is. Those restrictions are actually pretty minimal. Those restrictions represent when my exercising of my rights starts to interfere with the rights of other people. If you think about workplaces, owners should have rights, but their rights should not be so absolute that they restrict the practice of a democratic society and the right of workers to organize and to express their collective rights. If you want to understand what's going on right now in a nutshell, it's basically corporations represent tremendous private concentration of wealth and power. They're not subjected, for the most part, to democratic control, and they are currently on a tremendous campaign to seek to undermine all democratic institutions. They have a program, and it has three platforms: privatization, deregulation, and free trade. It's sometimes referred to as the neoliberal agenda. But essentially, it has the same in common. It seeks to take things from the common, those things that we have democratic control over, or that we own, or that we have legislated in the interests of the vast majority of us, and turn it over to markets. And this little shell game of saying, well, you know, democracy, you know, it's slow, it's sort of messy, let the market decide, is in fact a form of theft. It in fact moves things from a democracy, one person, one vote, to a very different situation, $1, one vote. Not exactly the same thing. Privatization turns over publicly held goods, services, and to private interests, selling the airways, waterfront, forests, hospitals, prisons, welfare administration. Where will it stop? Deregulation is re-regulating on behalf of corporations, limiting their responsibility to the public at large, while continuing to guarantee their rights, such as intellectual properties, against the rights of all of us. And free trade, well, I remember I used to debate this issue, but a right-wing economist in Canada brilliantly summarized free trade. He said, and I quote, "A trade agreement simply limits the extent to which a signatory country can respond to pressure from its citizens." Oops. Well, responding to pressure from your citizens is what we used to call democracy. Anyway, this attempt to turn everything over to the markets is a tremendous grab for power, and in fact is the destruction of democracy and civil society as we know it. Because they understand What has always been my personal motto, the best way to predict the future is to create it. And they've got an agenda, and they're creating a very scary future. Now, I have some modest suggestions about how we can start to roll that back. And much of this conference tonight and tomorrow is going to be discussing how we do that. And I have four little suggestions, five actually. One is that I think we need to not be afraid to give a moral, not just an economic critique. And by that I mean, you know, so often we get caught up, we get into cost benefits analysis, and we forget to look at who's paying the cost and who's getting the benefits. We also think that economics in and of itself can prove the case. Let me give you an example. Massachusetts, the state system, University of Massachusetts, it's four or five campuses, it pays for itself over 10 years. That is, the vast majority of people who go to the University of Massachusetts actually stay in our state. Because they're now university graduates, they earn more than non-university graduates. Therefore, we still have a somewhat graduated tax system. They pay higher taxes. And so it works out that within 10 years, the money the state puts in pays for itself. A colleague did a wonderful study. We were talking on post-secondary education on a panel. And he got up and he gave this explanation and said, you know, that's all we need. So I said, no, we got to make the moral argument about why we have post-secondary institutions, about, you know, the equity mission of universities and all the rest of it. He said, no, we don't. So I got up after him and I said, well, you know, I have a PhD, and my PhD is from the public universities in Canada. So I have a modest suggestion about what we can do at Massachusetts to maximize our gain. Shut down the public university system and import intelligent labor like myself. That way, we get all of the gains, none of the costs, and, you know, it'll work out. From a cost benefits point of view, it'd be terrific. But do you want to live in that state? Do you want to live in that sort of society? I think not. Mind you, the governor's sitting there making notes, sounds good to me. So that, you see, if you always argue just the economics and you don't root it on the values that we hold as a society. So don't be afraid. Much of what school's about is trying to tell you, you know, let's look at the hard facts. Look at the hard facts, but don't be afraid of your values. Don't be afraid to talk about those values. And don't be afraid that facts, to give feet to the facts, give movement to the facts. The second point is build communities and build collectives and advocate public decision-making, accountability, and process over private mechanisms and markets. You know, sometimes people forget. You know, we forget that communities are built. You know, one of the things you learn in the labor movement is that not everybody is privileged to walk into a workplace that already has a union. Most people increasingly today have to construct the union themselves. People might be in a workplace together, but they're not in a community. They have not yet constructed a community of interest. What happens is when they organize, when they join together as men and women with different ethnic backgrounds, different ages, different religions, different concerns, increasingly different languages, and they start to discuss their interests in the workplace, what they are doing is constructing a community of interest, because that's what unions do. And anytime you build an organization, you're doing the fundamental construction of democracy. You are constructing a community where there once was isolated individuals, nervous and scared. You start to pull them together, decide on a direction, engage in debate and discussion. That's constructing communities of interest. And in doing that, that's fundamental to a democracy. The third point is recognize in all of this that we're in for a very long struggle. In fact, I would argue, make it a lifetime struggle. There's no magic bullet. There's no magic slogan. In fact, I tend to think that slogans are sort of dangerous. They give the appearance of quick fixes. I love the way the anti-sweat movement's moved. I like the fact that it's grown. It's grown beyond just apparel into a living wage. It's grown beyond just concerned about workers and, in the third world and in the South and in developing countries into workers right here on the campus itself. And it's not abandoning one and going to the other. It's growing the issue, and that's terrific. The fourth point is get radical. We're living in radical times. If you do nothing, things will change radically in your lifetime. The point is, if you're not involved, it won't change in the direction you want to. My own view is that I like to be 10 degrees more radical than I want to be. I figure out what's the wildest thing I can do, and then I try to move 10 degrees further because I know my natural conservatism will kick in. Don't be afraid to do that. In my mind, this is a terrific time. One of the funny things is that innovation comes out of weakness, not out of strength. The fact that the labor movement is now down to only 12-13% in the private sector is a real opportunity. See, when labor was 35%, it was the big guy on the block, and I do mean big guy. It could stoop down in a charitable way to help the unfortunate, but it didn't need you. It didn't even want to listen to you. It'd probably boot your ass if you came near it. But that's not labor anymore. That's not labor anymore. Labor all of a sudden is much weaker. And because it's weak, it knows it's got to have allies. It's got to do things different. It is more open than it has ever been in this century to ideas, to innovation, to trying different things. And that's a terrific time. That's a terrific time to be involved. And in fact, get radical. Get radical. Finally, even the largest, strongest movement or collective starts with one. Don't freak out about size. Don't worry that, you know, when you first start out, that, you know, whether it's a campaign in defense of campus workers, whether it's a campaign here on campus, whether it in fact is bringing an anti-sweat campaign to a high school or another college, don't worry that only 4 or 5 people come. Every movement, you know, history does a little bit of a disservice to us. We all look at the pictures, you know, the pictures of John L. Lewis and the CIO, or the pictures of Martin Luther King and the Civil Rights Movement, and we all want to be with those winners, right? Because they won. And by the time they were taking pictures, there were thousands of people. But what we forget is these guys started with one or two in isolation with just a few of their neighbors, and even their neighbors not sure about them. That's the way movements grow. Solidarity is us. That's what labor needs to be. No longer just no longer contracts are us, but in fact the labor movement that says solidarity is us. That we forge solidarity through informed consent, through debate, through discussion, through genuine participation. And that's the type of thing that you'll be doing today. So we make our own history, we make it by walking, we make it by doing, and we make it by kicking ass. So take care and solidarity.
That was Elaine Bernard speaking at Cornell University late last year. You're listening to Unwelcome Guests on WEOS Geneva. On the days when you feel spent, why let your shoulders bend underneath this burden? Prohibition accounts for over 50% of the 2 million people currently imprisoned. It's important to note that in addition to this figure, there are approximately 2.5 million drug offenders on parole or supervised release. This does not enumerate the further millions that have exited the system having finished probation. Among the war's many tragic consequences, and by far the worst, is the criminalization of a vast, ever-increasing percentage of our population, destroying families and individuals by the millions. We are now the world's leading jailer. Even communist China, who we criticize for its slave labor camps, imprisons at a lesser rate. We make a mockery of the once cherished phrase, land of the free. The destruction is massive and with a rippling effect on the family. There are between 1 and 2 million orphans of the drug war. This is the politics of prohibition. There are now criminal records on 50 million Americans. According to a 1996 report of the National Criminal Justice Commission, it is common for federal prosecutors to threaten drug defendants with mandatory sentences unless they incriminate others. Many defendants decide to inform on their associates and friends in an effort to get a lighter prison sentence. This practice frays bonds of personal trust and corrodes the community cohesion that might otherwise act as a buffer to violence. In other words, we've turned the United States into all of the things we abhorred about Russia, Cuba, and Nazi Germany. The Drug Awareness and Resistance Education Program, DARE, routinely teaches children to inform on friends and parents for suspected drug use, even if they put mommy and daddy in jail or prison, destroying careers, marriages, and family. Not only that, the DARE program and its progeny, at a cost of $500 million a year, simply does not work. Our American culture has become a hyped-up, super-speed society where the media drives materialistic values into a person's very core. It should come as no surprise when, having stripped certain classes of people of meaningful jobs, not flipping hamburgers, but jobs that can support a family, that persons are seduced by the lure of high, quick, tax-free profit. One should more appropriately wonder what intricacies of American life cause the psychic pain which only an altered state of mind allays. Rather than seek the answers to this thorny question, politicians make scapegoats of natural impulses and crime of consensual activity. Thanks to the war on drugs, the rate of incarceration for women has increased by 400% since 1986 and risen by 800% among black women. Two-thirds of the women in U.S. prisons have been sentenced on nonviolent drug offenses.
We'll conclude our program with the voices of women who have been casualties of the drug war. These personal testimonies were recorded on a hotline set up by the anti-drug war group, the November Coalition. Their website, www.november.org, is well worth the visit if you wish to learn about the negative effects of the war on drugs.
Hi, I'm Amy Pofal, and I'm serving a 24-year sentence for conspiracy to distribute ecstasy. And I'm presently serving my seventh year at FCI Dublin in California. The nature of my complaint is that the female inmates, myself included, are subject to the whims of personnel who often use and abuse their positions and as vehicles to exercise their own prejudices, sometimes their own self-hatred or personality flaws upon inmates who have no recourse and are at their mercy. A prime example of this is a situation we now have in the visiting room. There's a particular officer who's assigned to the visiting room who has decided that she doesn't like to escort inmates to the bathroom, although according to the rules, we cannot go to the bathroom without an escort. On January 10th, at approximately 2 o'clock, I asked the officer if I could go to the bathroom, and she told me to wait because she was busy. I observed her, and she was not busy. Rather, she was talking to her coworker, laughing, etc. 20 minutes later, and several more requests, she finally relented and escorted me to the bathroom just in time. She told me that, quote, "I don't like to take people to the bathroom." And I thought she was just making a comment and said, "Yes, I understand. I wouldn't like it either." She said, "No, you don't understand. Next time you'll have to hold it." I was rather stunned, and I didn't know whether she was kidding or not, but I said, "Well, I wish I could hold it, but God didn't God didn't devise me that way. And she said, well, this is a busy part of the day, and from now on, after 2 o'clock, I won't take anyone to the bathroom. So I refused to argue with her any further, and I returned to my visit, but subsequently reported it to the warden, who said she would resolve it. And the problem has since escalated, and 2 weeks ago, the same officer refused to escort a lady to the bathroom, nor would she let the other officer working under her take the inmate to the bathroom, who asked to go at noontime. The result was that the woman defecated on herself due to diarrhea, which she made them aware of. Again, yesterday, I approached the warden and asked her if this problem had been resolved, because I'm expecting a visit this Sunday, and I don't want to be subject to this abuse. The warden acted as though this was the first she'd ever heard of the issue, even though I had personally. Anyway, I know for a fact the other inmate has filed a complaint and confronted the warden. I don't know whether the issue will be resolved or not, but this is part of living in prison in America. Thank you. I hope you think about it. Bye.
My name is Karen Hoffman. I'm calling from behind the wall in Marianna, Florida. This is the highest security women's federal prison in the country. I'm serving a nonviolent offense for LSD. Last June, I beat 6 mandatory life without parole sentences. I'm now down to 15 years. I've traveled all around the federal system. I was sent here after being falsely accused of the riot in 1995. This is the most depressing facility I've ever been at. The warden came through last year, took out any plant on the yard that had a flower on it. He took away all recreation, all arts and crafts. He took the plants out of our rooms. Just recently, they've now come around and they've hung doors with food slots. It looks like a death row unit. They're getting ready to lock us down all the time. Tonight was the 4th suicide attempt here in 30 days. Tonight, the woman was a friend of mine. She's a 40-year-old woman, a mother of 2, who is a first-time offender doing a 25-year mandatory minimum sentence for a drug conspiracy case. I don't know, I just wish the people would realize, you know, what's really going on here. She didn't hurt anybody, I didn't hurt anybody. A lot of us are here because of the conspiracy, merely because somebody else said so. Thanks, bye.
Hi, my name is Selena Kingsley, and I'd like to tell you a little bit about how the war on drugs has affected our family. In 1995, in 2 separate court dates, my husband was sentenced to a total of 20 years in prison for dealing in methamphetamine. But we were stunned, just putting it mildly. We didn't understand mandatory minimums. You know, we were just numb. We had no idea that he was going to get that kind of sentence for such a small amount of crank. 2 weeks later, we kind of got slapped in the face by reality, because that's when we found out I was pregnant. Such an emotional thing. On one hand, all we could think about was what he and the baby would miss out, what I would have to go through on the outside by myself. On the other hand, it was a blessing, because we had such a long sentence in front of us, and I could very conceivably be too old to have any kids by the time he came home. JJ was born in January of 96, and due to telephone restrictions, he was 3 hours old before his daddy knew he was born. JJ is really the focus of my story. He's 28 months old now, and he is identical to his daddy in looks, temperament, and actions. It alternately warms my heart and breaks it. Of all the damage that's been done, the damage to him is the greatest, I think. JJ loves to go bye-bye to Dada's house. He was 12 days old the first time he went through shakedown. I keep a wicker basket full of pictures. You can literally see our baby growing up in cheap Polaroids taken by the state. Even at his age, he knows the routine. A few weeks ago, we were in the grocery store, and there was a state trooper in uniform. JJ went up to him with a big smile, and the cop bent down to talk to him, and JJ outstretches his arms because he associates the uniform with getting shaken down. I started crying right in the store and just led him away. You know, the pain just doesn't stop. At our facility, we wait in a glass-dimmed room until my husband comes in from the back. JJ stands with his little face pressed right against the glass, watching each offender until that magical moment when Dad Eddie appears. Then against all the rules, he's flying out the door, his little chubby arms outstretched, hollering, "JJ's dad." The guards can't help but smile at him. We do our best to make, you know, visits our family time. We can't take any toys in, so they spend like hundreds of hours making paper airplanes, choo-choo trains out of Snicker bars, threading paper towels through Lifesavers to make cars. But all too soon, our name's called and it's time to leave. And JJ doesn't understand why Daddy can't come home. A lot of times at the end of the visit, I'll carry him away and he'll be screaming, "No, no, bye-bye, Dad, no, no." The guards turn their heads like they're ashamed. His daddy dies another silent death, and I carry him away crying. In closing, I'll add I'm an incest victim for 6 counts of child molestation, 3 counts of rape, and the shattered innocence of 5 lives. My stepfather received the exact same sentence as my husband. Bitter, damned right I am.
A letter from Becky Stewart, number 34290-080. Dear Judge, will you be spending Christmas with your family and loved ones this year? Will there be lots of Christmas presents under a bright, adorned tree? I will not be spending Christmas with my family this year, nor will there be lots of presents under a bright, adorned tree. For you gave me an 18-year sentence, which means I will spend 15 Christmases away from my family and home. Because under federal sentencing guidelines, there is no such thing as parole anymore. I, along with thousands of other nonviolent drug offenders, will do 85% of our time here in prison, and most of us, we will be far away from home. Do you know what it's like here in prison and what one of our days consists of? You wake up in the morning and ask God to give you strength to make it through another day, for you do not know what it may bring. You just hope that when you call home, one of your loved ones is not sick, or worse yet, have not passed away. There is such a feeling of hopelessness when you call home and listen to the family's troubles, knowing that if only you were there, you could help in some small way. Our families suffer too, wanting always to know when we are coming home. What, if anything, they can do to help expedite our returning to them, knowing that when they ask, there is nothing they can do. Due to new federal laws, our appeal rights have been seriously curbed, and the expense of lawyers many of us cannot afford. For most of us are middle or lower class. You do not often see the rich and famous in here. Very rarely. Isn't O.J. Simpson the classic example? As are Kuhn and Powell, the policemen who were given downward departures in the Rodney King beating. They were given a 30-month reduced sentence for beating a man and caught red-handed at that on videotape. And yet we, who have not beaten anyone, nor killed anyone, are given 10, 15, 18 to 30 years imprisonment for drug offenses where there is no violence whatsoever. I do not have children who wait on my return. The dream was extinguished when you gave me my 18-year sentence, for I will be too old when I am released. Maybe I'm fortunate that I don't have a child, because I see the anguish and tears of mothers watching their children from afar, growing up without them, crying after they speak with them on the telephone. Most of them know that they have become just a voice on the other end of the telephone, a voice that a child calls mommy in name only. For the years being separated puts a distance between them. The clique that time only makes the heart grow fonder does not apply in prison. The song, "Time goes by slowly, and time can do so much," more aptly describes it. We are given so much time that we are the forgotten ones, destined to become just the number you gave me, number 34290-080. Instead of calling us by name. In here we are called by our last names or our federal prison numbers. Gone are our given names. But there are a few who still remember our names, the names given to us at birth. loved ones who still miss us deeply as we miss them. I do not have children waiting for me, but I do still have family and my 88-year-old grandfather. Legally, he is my father. He adopted me when I was 4 years old and is the best father anyone could ask for. He has always been there for me as a child through my teens and the many mistakes we all make trying to be an adult. My one and only dream now is to be there for him when he needs me. My grandfather lives alone and has no one there to care for him. He suffered a heart attack and now has a pacemaker. To make matters worse, a couple of months ago he fell down and now requires a wheelchair. An agency sends someone to check on him 3 times a week, taking his vitals and such, but my papa, I have called him that since I was a little girl, requires full-time care now. We tried a live-in companion, but it did not work out. People tend to take advantage of our older generation. One time I called home to find out the companion had left a heating pad on my grandfather. It had been set too high and burned his legs badly. My heart cried out with pain and such a feeling of hopelessness and guilt, because I know that if I were there, no such incidents would occur. My grandfather asks me every year, "When are you coming home?" He knows I'm not a vicious criminal and has a hard time understanding why I was given such a long prison sentence. Every year, especially at Christmas, he will ask the inevitable question, "Will you be here this year?" And every year I tell him, "Soon." We both know in our hearts it is not to be. So, Judge, when you're spending Christmas with your family and loved ones this year, with lots of Christmas presents under your bright adorned tree, think of my grandfather, who sits alone and waits for me. Merry Christmas, Judge. Inmate Stewart, number 34290-080. P.S. My drug violation was a nonviolent offense based upon a conspiracy charge. A conspiracy to manufacture where there was no lab, no lab equipment, nor chemicals found in my possession. All co-conspirators, except for the one who was facing a life sentence, told the truth and said there was no agreement or thought of manufacturing drugs. But because the DEA believed that we were going to set up a lab, I was convicted of a conspiracy. And this, a letter to the November Coalition, from Kim Flowers, number 07140-112. January 10th, 1998, Dublin Federal Prison Camp in California. Dear November Coalition, I'm a POW. I just heard of you and your cause. Jesus said, "Give honor to whom honor is due." I give all honor to what you are doing for us POWs and our families. I'm writing you briefly about something Jesus said over 2,000 years ago that still applies today. I and my family included will join you in your quest, and I will soon be sending you my story of how and why I'm serving a 41-month, 3 years, 5 month sentence, and my husband, Michael Flowers, is serving 151 months, almost 13 years, sentence. Jesus was speaking to the scribes and Pharisees, the lawmakers of that generation. You can very well see that he is also speaking to the lawmakers of our generation. Jesus was talking about our president, Congress, the government, U.S. attorneys, and all lawmakers and enforcers. Jesus said, Woe to you, lawmakers and hypocrites, for you are like whitewashed tombs, which indeed appear beautiful outwardly, but inside are full of dead men's bones and all kinds of filth. Even so you appear righteous to men, but inside you are full of hypocrisy and lawlessness. Matthew 23, verses 27 and 28. Keep up the good work. Sincerely, Kim Flowers.
Thanks for tuning in to Unwelcome Guests. Our theme song, Unwelcome Guest, was performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Other music used in the program, Bread and Roses by Joan Baez and Mimi Farina, Working Class Hero performed by Marianne Faithful, and Trouble Me by 10,000 Maniacs. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lynn, Ling Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content. Napping one day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end for my God.